So I know I'm not the first to say it, but welcome to Cornell and welcome to Ithaca. My name is Derek Chang. I teach in the History Department and in Asian American Studies. You've drawn, well, I was going to say the short straw, but whatever straw it is that you draw to get assigned to this particular event, which is part of, as you well know, the first year reading project. And it's the part of the first year reading project entitled Cornell Contexts. Sort of thinking along those lines, what I'd like to do today is to try to provide you a kind of historical context to Julio Tsuka's When the Emperor Was Divine, a novel that takes place during the Second World War that chronicles, as you well know, the experiences of a family, a Japanese-American family, during the Second World War as they're evacuated, that's the term of the time, from Berkeley, California, and interned, incarcerated, really, in a what they called at the time a concentration camp, what we have come to call internment camp, in the desert of Utah. So a lot of today will be about history, about the facts, right, about what happened. I'm going to apologize because when I start the lecture, I'm going to go over here and I'm going to try to be pretty formal about this. I understand there will be time after the lecture for Q&A, and I hope it'll be a little less formal then. But while I'm trying to impart sort of the facts, right, the historical context of Japanese internment to try to chronicle what happened, right, how we got to the point where the book begins, I also want to try to model in some way, right, or provide a kind of cue for you as you embark on your college careers, right, a set of questions, right, that might help you understand or help you help guide you as you encounter your classes over the next 3 or 4 years at Cornell, right? And those questions are why, right? And how, right? So not just what happened, but why did it happen and how did it happen, right? So today hopefully, as you get this sort of litany of facts, and hopefully it won't be too boring and it won't be just a litany of facts, but as you get a litany of facts, I'm hoping that I'll show you, right, that by asking the question of why and how, right, those two questions, that you will begin to sort of peel away certain layers and develop not just sort of a chronicle of what happened, but a set of interpretations and perhaps even argument for why and how internment occurred, right? So that's sort of the project. That's sort of the project for today, right? So I'm going to talk a lot about American nationalism and race and white supremacy in particular in the context of Japanese internment. All right, so here's that's sort of the overview of what I hope to accomplish today. Right, and so the way I want to proceed actually when I sort of get to the body of the lecture is to sort of work backwards in Otsuka's novel, right? She opens the novel right in the spring of 1942 on a sunny spring day in Berkeley, right? And the first chapter is called Evacuation Order Number 19, right? And one of the protagonists, the woman, right, sees Evacuation Order Number 19, and we follow her as she makes preparations for her family to be evacuated from Berkeley. And then the novel moves forward in time, right? Taking us from evacuation to incarceration and then back to Berkeley, the return at the end of the war. What I'd like to do is move backwards, right? Move backwards in three successive chronological layers. One is I want to take the first chunk of time immediately preceding the first chapter of Otsuka's novel, right? To look at from February 19th, 1942, those of you who remember your American history from 11th grade will know that February 19th, 1942 was the day that Franklin Delano Roosevelt, right, the president at the time, issued Executive Order 9066, which paves the way, right? Which paves the way for Japanese internment. So I'm going to move from 9066 through the evacuation orders and give you a little sense of what happened during that time, right? And then I'm going to move backwards even further, right? And look at that sort of two plus months between the bombing of Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, right, and the issuance of Executive Order 9066. And then Once I've talked about that, I want to move back in time even further, right, and look at what happened, the experience really of Japanese and Japanese Americans prior to the bombing of Pearl Harbor, right? So what I'm hoping to do that as we peel away, or as I peel away these successive chronological layers, as I said before, I'm hoping that to move beyond a kind of litany of sort of chronologically ordered facts and to develop an interpretation, right? An interpretation of the American past, but also something that might be food for thought as we sort of look at some of the dilemmas and challenges of our own time now, right? So that's the agenda for today. All right, so before we begin, a couple notes on terminology, right? You will hear me use the terms that were used at the time, evacuation, relocation, and internment. And what I'd like us to do is, as I use these words over the course of this lecture, I'd like us to sort of imagine air quotes, right, around those terms, because my sense is, as a historian studying these things, that the arrest, detention, incarceration without due process of law of 120,000 men, women, and children of Japanese descent, the majority of whom were American citizens, those terms don't quite capture the enormity of the civil rights and civil liberties violations of the time, right? So they're kind of euphemisms. So when I say evacuation, relocation, and internment, I'd like you to sort of think, all right, arrest, detention, incarceration, right, imprisonment, right? And quite apart from that sort of interpretive note on terminology, there are two terms that never appear in Otsuka's novel, but which are crucial, right, for how we're going to understand Japanese internment. And there are these two terms that come from Japanese, right? One is the issei, which is reference to folks who were born in Japan and immigrated to the U.S., right? These are Japanese immigrants, and by law, they're referred to as aliens, right? So issei, a synonym, is sort of a word for Japanese immigrant. You also might sort of think alien, right? The second word is nisei, which would be the children, right, of Japanese immigrants born in the U.S., by virtue of law, American citizens. And so we have two different generations. And so I'll use those words over the course of the lecture from time to time, issei and nisei, right? Immigrant, right? Immigrant and American-born Japanese, alien and citizen, right? Those are the two crucial terms. All right. Just another note before we begin, maybe to set the frame for the rest of the lecture. In 1982, right, and Personal Justice Denied is the name of the publication that came from this U.S. government commission on wartime relocation and incarceration of civilians. In 1982, this commission concluded, and I'm going to quote at length here, the promulgation of Executive Order 9066 was not justified by military necessity, and the decisions which followed from it were not driven by analysis of military conditions. A grave injustice was done to American citizens and resident aliens of Japanese ancestry who, without individual review or other probative evidence against them, were excluded, removed, and detained by the U.S. During World War II, right? And in fact, right, in fact, even though at the time Japanese internment was ordered by President Franklin Roosevelt, implemented by Congress without a dissenting vote, executed by the military, upheld by the Supreme Court, and applauded by the vast majority of Americans, all in the name of military necessity, the Commission's investigation and report led Congress to pass and President Ronald Reagan to sign in August 1988 the Civil Liberties Act. Right? The act constituted an official apology to the survivors of internment and authorized the payment of $20,000 in reparation to each survivor. So if some 40 years later, the U.S. Commission, the U.S. Congress, the U.S. President all concluded that Japanese internment was a grave injustice, then why and how did it happen? Right? This is what I hope we can begin to answer today. And for me, right, the path to answering those questions begins by trying to understand the opening chapter of Otsuka's novel. What is to account for the woman's demeanor in that first chapter? Why isn't she angrier, right, when faced with this grave injustice? How did this grave injustice occur? All right, so February 19th, 1942 through March 31st, 1942. In the opening chapter of When the Emperor Was Divine, readers accompany the woman, right, one of the main protagonists of Otsuka's novel, as she makes preparations in advance of her evacuation from her family's home in Berkeley. Otsuka's terse prose carries readers through the woman's final day in Berkeley before she moves with her children and only those possessions they could carry, first to an assembly center and then to an internment camp in the desert of Utah. Otsuka describes the woman warily burying family valuables, disposing of family pets, and destroying any memento or family object associated with Japan. Perhaps it is Otsuka's matter-of-fact account, but the woman's actions speak to me of a kind of tired resignation. And we know, because it constitutes the very first sentence of the book, that the woman is preparing to leave her home in response most immediately to the sign, right? And I'm going to quote here. The sign that had appeared overnight on billboards and trees and the backs of the bus stop benches. It hung in the window of Woolworth's. It hung by the entrance to the YMCA. It was stapled to every door of the municipal court and nailed at eye level to every telephone pole along University Avenue. What Otsuka's compressed and elegant language does not reveal so obviously is that this order, right, evacuation order number 19, might have appeared overnight, but it was hardly a surprise to Japanese-American inhabitants of Berkeley. Indeed, it followed a number of other edicts. Most infamously, on February 19, 1942, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had signed Executive Order 9066. This order did not mention Japanese Americans explicitly, but it gave the U.S. military broad powers to ban, quote, any or all persons, right, from designated military areas and authorize the military to transport them to other accommodations. Within 11 days, right, in less than 2 weeks, General John L. DeWitt, head of the Western Defense Command, acted on the authority granted by Roosevelt's order. He issued the creatively titled Public Proclamation Number 1 on March 2nd, dividing Washington State, Oregon, California, and Arizona into two military areas, Area 1 along the coast and Area 2 inland. Public Proclamation Number 2, released 2 weeks later, added four more military areas. And this is actually an image of not Civilian Exclusion Order Number 19, but Civilian Exclusion Order Number 5 for a different area of the Bay Area there in San Francisco. And that's another, that's sort of the flip side of the evacuation order. So you get a sense of what the woman, right, encountered on that spring day in Berkeley. So Public Proclamation Number 2 was released 2 weeks after Public Proclamation Number 1, and added four more military areas, right, extending east to Idaho, Montana, Nevada, and Utah. Public Proclamation Number 3 on March 27th established a curfew in Area 1 for, quote, all enemy aliens, right, these would be people born in countries with whom the U.S. was at war, right, and quote, persons of Japanese ancestry, right? Public Proclamation Number 3 also restricted the daytime movements of these folks, right, enemy aliens and persons of Japanese ancestry, to, quote, not more than 5 miles from their place of residence. This was the first directive, the first order to violate directly the civil liberties of Japanese Americans. In the meantime, Roosevelt had established the War Relocation Authority, the WRA, by executive order on March 18th to oversee the building and administration of detention camps. And Congress had passed Public Law 503 on March 21st to establish sanctions for those who violated Executive Order 9066. Right? Public Law 503 was really the enabling legislation from Congress. To make the roundup, incarceration, and transportation easier. On March 30th, public proclamation number 4 restricted all people of Japanese ancestry, not, I should note, other enemy aliens, from leaving Area 1, right? And here's a sort of sign that's sort of indicating that this is military area number 1, right? It's a prohibited zone. But even before public proclamation number 4, the Army, with help from the U.S. Census Bureau, began issuing civilian exclusion orders. The first came on March 26th on Bainbridge Island in Washington State. It ordered all persons of Japanese ancestry, both alien and non-alien alike, right, Issei and Nisei alike, to be prepared for removal on March 31st. All right, so the steady drumbeat of military edicts handed down in the 5.5 weeks between Roosevelt's executive order and the first of the civilian exclusion orders meant that the woman, right, as she stoically dispatches with the family dog, wrings the rooster's neck, packs and hides her family's belongings, and destroys her material links to Japan, would not have been surprised on that sunny day in Berkeley. The Asian American scholar Jane Iwamura writes, "The initial response to mass incarceration of most Japanese Americans could be encapsulated by the phrase, Shikata Ganai, or it cannot be helped now." She cautions, though, against seeing this philosophical phrase as merely fatalism. Rather, it implies in its utterance the need to move on with life in the face of circumstances one cannot adequately explain and does not have the power to change. It allowed internees to concentrate on survival rather than on the things they'd lost, right? So this phrase, Shikata Ganai, becomes sort of one way of trying to understand how that how the woman acts in that first chapter in particular. Iwamura, though, cautions further that the phrase is often associated erroneously with an attitude of passivity. The emphasis for Japanese Americans was rather on those things that they could do something about. She writes, "As circumstances allow for greater action, Shikata Ganai does not relieve one of responsibility. Its ultimate aim is not to debilitate, but rather to revitalize in the face of adversities that seem beyond one's control." All right. So this concept of Shikata Ganai is pretty important here. But I'll note in passing, although I think it deserves something more than just a passing note, that contrary perhaps to the popular image of passivity and victimization that often comes from representations of Japanese wartime incarceration, numerous Japanese immigrants, right, the Issei, and Americans of Japanese ancestry, Nisei, vigorously protested and in some cases actively resisted internment. Most famous are the legal cases. Fred Korematsu, Gordon Hirabayashi, and Min Yasui all challenged the constitutionality of various aspects of internment, although it's important to note, right, that they lost their cases during the war, that the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality at the time of internment. All right, and here's a picture of the three of them. All right. And in February 1943, another example of resistance at the Heart Mountain, Wyoming internment camp, a group of Nisei established a fair play committee when the U.S. military and the WRA circulated a questionnaire to determine if they were loyal enough to be drafted and to serve in the armed forces. Right, there were two questions on the form. I believe, if memory serves, they're questions number 26 and 27, asking about the loyalty of these Nisei men in particular. And folks who answered that they weren't going to defend the U.S. Constitution and that they wouldn't be loyal to the U.S. Were referred to as no-no boys. Right, they answered no to both of these questions. At any rate, the Fair Play Committee, which consisted of politically motivated draft resistors or no-no boys, right? The Fair Play Committee eventually numbered around 100 people at the Wyoming, at the Heart Mountain, Wyoming camp, and they were joined by another 200 people in other camps around the country, right? 63 of these no-no boys in Wyoming. 63 were arrested, tried and convicted of draft evasion in the state's largest mass trial ever. But the point here is that they saw what was wrong, or that they felt that something was wrong, that their civil liberties had been violated, and they, in fact, did something about it, right? To sort of counter the notion of passivity here. And this document, which I don't know if you can read or not, is a sort of a draft of minutes or an agenda from a Fair Play Committee meeting at Heart Mountain, Wyoming. And what's interesting, and you know, this is sort of off topic, but I find it interesting, is to note that they're adamant in the Fair Play Committee, they're not just trying to get out of the draft, right, because they don't want to go fight overseas, right? But they're resisting the draft actively because this is not what the Constitution, this is not how they're supposed to be treated according to the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, right? And that until the U.S. government upholds their end of the bargain, right, the idea of fighting for that country is unpalatable, to say the least, right? So that's the Fair Play Committee. All right. So, but even when they didn't organize through legal or collective action, those who were subject to internment understood that internment was in fact a violation of their rights. Right? For the Issei generation, those who had been born in Japan and immigrated to the U.S., the resignation implied by Shikata Gannai perhaps hid feelings of disgrace and humiliation. Right? Yamato Ichihashi, 64 years old in 1942, had been born in Nagoya, Japan, and came to the U.S. at the age of 16. He attended public school in San Francisco, graduated with bachelor's and master's degrees in economics and government from Stanford, and earned his doctorate at Harvard. In 1913, he returned to Stanford to teach Japanese history and government. In the late spring of 1942, Ichihashi and his 50-year-old wife, Kay, began their wartime odyssey from Palo Alto to the Assembly Center at the Santa Anita Racetrack in Southern California, to the Tule Lake Relocation Center for alleged pro-Japan prisoners, to the camp in Granada, Colorado. It's not going too far to say that few people in the United States knew more about the international relations between Japan and America, and no U.S.-based academic had a better sense of the position of Japanese in America. So when the Palo Alto evacuation order came, it's no surprise that sort of a quiet forbearance seemed to be the attitude struck by Ichihashi, right? And he never says so himself. In fact, he leaves reams, right, volumes of diaries and letters from his experience in internment. He's writing letters to all sorts of friends on the outside, including the president of Stanford at the time, talking about his experiences. But he never writes about what it felt like to be ordered to leave his home in Palo Alto, right? But we have some hints about this, right? So in fact, a fellow faculty member's wife, who was part of the American Friends Committee, who was sort of giving aid to folks who were being evacuated, a faculty member's wife recalls seeing Ichihashi and his wife as they boarded the bus, right, from Palo Alto to Santa Anita, as they were leaving their homes for what they had no idea. And she sensed, she sensed the humiliation Yamato must have been feeling. She could see it in his body language, right? So we get a sense of that disgrace, that humiliation, perhaps a way of beginning to explain Shikata Gannai, right? For those men and women of Japanese descent born in the United States, right, American citizens by law, the Nisei, the feelings of anger and betrayal may have burned brighter, but the spirit of Shikata Gannai also seemed to pervade. Jack Tono, right, and there's a picture of Jack Tono on the lower right there. Jack Tono was a 21-year-old agricultural worker who had grown up on a strawberry farm in Northern California. Incarcerated first at the same assembly center as Professor Ichihashi and then sent to the Heart Mountain camp, Tono recalled his disappointment at the evacuation order. "I said, what the heck? We didn't commit a thing and we have to be evacuated. I didn't understand the whole atmosphere of the thing, being a citizen, that they would commit us to prison in a camp without a trial or nothing. That really got to me." Yet his fury and his disgust with the situation was tempered by the overwhelming power of the American state. How did I react to Heart Mountain? I didn't react. I was only a kid then. And what I saw wasn't right, but we couldn't do much, right? So first that sort of feeling that you were up against the might of the U.S. military and the American state sort of undercuts attempts at resistance. Now, Tono's framing of his response to Heart Mountain provides some clues to what I think comes through in the woman's actions in Otsuka's prose. The kind of tired expectation, right, the knowledge that internment would happen, especially, as Tono puts it, after everything else. Right? We know from the oral histories of Japanese Americans that this was a common response. Tom Kawaguchi, who would be incarcerated in Topaz in Arizona and who would volunteer to serve with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in Europe, which, by the way, was the most decorated combat team in all of Europe during the Second World War, American combat team, made up of Japanese-American soldiers, right? Tom Kawaguchi remembered that after the issuance of Executive Order 9066, quote, all kinds of rumors were flying around that we would all be placed in prison and so forth. They knew. Right, they knew. So I want to take us now from December 7th, right, Pearl Harbor Day, 1941, through that moment just before Executive Order 9066. Right, how did they know this was going to happen? And I would like to submit that the experiences of Japanese Americans in the 9.5 weeks following the attack on Pearl Harbor, right, but before Roosevelt's executive order, perhaps as much as the order itself, put them on notice that something ominous was on its way. As most of us know, at about 7:45 in the morning, local time, on December 7th, 1941, Japanese aircraft appeared in the sky above the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. Within a matter of hours, most of the U.S. Pacific fleet was destroyed. 8 battleships sunk, 1 grounded, 1 capsized. In all, 19 ships were disabled or sunk, and 188 aircraft at Hickam Field and other airfields on the island were destroyed, not to mention more than 2,300 military personnel and civilians killed, and more than 1,100 wounded. This surprise attack propelled the U.S. into the Second World War the very next day. Now, December 7th was a Sunday, and 27-year-old schoolteacher Mary Tsukamoto was at her church in Florin, California. Tsukamoto played the piano at the Sunday service. And she remembers her husband, who had stayed home that day, running into the church when the service had ended. She recalled, "We just couldn't believe it. But he told us Japan had attacked Pearl Harbor. I remember how stunned we were." And suddenly, right, that day, she realized the whole world turned dark. For Tom Kawaguchi, the darkness descended quickly. He was 20 and living in San Francisco on December 7th. On December 8th, he was ordered to go to the FBI office to be interviewed. It seems that his position as a clerk at an import-export business made him especially suspect. Never mind that, as he said, I was a general clerk. I was just a flunky. In fact, he claimed to only be doing general accounting work. Within days, he was called to another meeting with the FBI, this time in his place of work. I was called down to the office, he remembered, and the FBI was there. I opened the desk drawer and showed what I had and so forth. After that, my boss told me, "We'll call you if we need you." And that was the end of it. I never went back to the office again. Kawaguchi and dozens, scores of Japanese Americans had been laid off. He recalled, "We used to march down to Mission Street and get our unemployment checks. Morale was low. We knew we couldn't find jobs elsewhere." In Seattle, Frank Katagi didn't lose his job right away, but he and his employer, a white man named Vincent Hallinan, discussed what the bombing might mean for Japanese Americans. December 7th was a Sunday, he remembered, so we were eating lunch together. Then the news came. So all of a sudden, you know, Vince, he was so surprised, and I was surprised too. Then Vince said, "You know how it is now. You may not be able to stay here anymore." Right? There was a sense immediately after the bombing of Pearl Harbor that things would get bad. But more commonly, those ideas were never articulated, rather they were just felt. Yuri Tateishi had been born and raised in Riverside, California. She was living with her husband and children in West Los Angeles on December 7, 1941, and she recalled, "On Pearl Harbor Day, the whole family was planning to go downtown, but when we heard the news, we didn't know whether to go out or not. We didn't know what the reactions of the people were, but we decided to go anyway. Of course, when people were staring at us, we weren't very comfortable, but I recall people didn't say anything. The reaction you got was, oh, those people, and it wasn't a very comfortable feeling." Emmy Samakawa, who worked at as a nurse at Emmanuel Hospital in Portland, Oregon, had the same sense. On December 7th, she recalls, "We'd just come home from church, and we heard it over the radio. Of course, everything goes through your mind. Now what? We're Japanese. I wonder how the neighbors feel toward us." Tom Kawaguchi remembers leaving the San Francisco Public Library on December 7th, just after hearing about the attack on Pearl Harbor. "I kind of got a funny feeling going home. I thought everybody and his uncle was staring at me, ready to pounce on me or something. I came back to Japantown, and the place was just stone quiet. You didn't see anyone around. You felt very apprehensive and thought that something big was going to happen." For many Nisei, and especially Issei, it didn't take long. While Kawaguchi was summoned to the FBI's office on December 8th, others were arrested. Remember, this is before Executive Order 9066. Donald Nakahata, who was 12 in 1942, was the son of a part-time newspaper man. His father was also active with the Japanese Community Association in the Bay Area, which, according to Nakahata, made him a prime target of the FBI. The elder Nakahata was arrested on December 7th or December 8th. His son, telling the story some 50 years later, couldn't actually remember. What he could remember was that his father, after hearing about the attack on Pearl Harbor, decided to write a story about the Japanese community in San Jose and its reaction to the attack. So young Donald walked his father to the bus stop. He recalled, we went down Pine Street, down to Fillmore, to the number 22 streetcar. "My father took the 22 streetcar and went to the Southern Pacific and took the train to San Jose, and that was the last I saw of him." He'd been arrested. The 3,500 Japanese Americans who lived on Terminal Island in Long Beach Harbor near the Port of Los Angeles knew well before February 19, 1942, what fate they might face. Yuri Kochiyama, who would go on to become an important activist in the Asian American and African American communities, saw her father arrested the day after Pearl Harbor. And in fact, the entire island was sealed off almost immediately after news of the attack hit the West Coast. Fred Fujikawa, who had been born in San Francisco but had grown up in nearby San Pedro, had a small medical practice on the island. On December 7th, he and his wife were hosting visitors from Sacramento, but they were stuck on Terminal Island because just as soon as the war started, within a matter of minutes, he recalled, they closed off the bridge and the ferry. He remembers going to the immigration station on the island to try to find a way for his friends to leave. It was the evening of the 7th, but he thought he might have some sway because he was often the medical officer asked to examine ill passengers as they arrived from Japan at the port. But when he got there, he remembered, one fellow I knew grabbed me and asked me to come this way. So I did. The next thing I knew, I was pushed up against the wall, and they had a long pole with a number on it. They pushed that against my chest and took my picture, two views. And then I told them, wait a minute, all I'm trying to do is a favor for my friends, trying to get them off the island. Get permission. They said, oh, we know that, Doc, we know that, but come with me anyway. And the next thing I knew, they were fingerprinting me. So they had my prints, they had my picture with a number on it. Right? He was treated like a criminal. Even before the issuance of Executive Order 9066 then, Japanese Americans' civil liberties were being violated. But perhaps the most important thing to note from all of this, beyond the fact that the violations themselves, is that many Japanese Americans saw these actions, just as they would see the actions that would follow 9066, not as an aberration, but rather as an extension of the racial prejudice they had experienced in their everyday lives even before Pearl Harbor. So this is the segment from the 1890s up until Pearl Harbor. Shig Doi, a 22-year-old farmer who would be imprisoned in the Tule Lake camp, but who had also served with distinction in the European theater, remembered growing up in rural Placer County, California. Well before Pearl Harbor, it was, quote, a hotbed of prejudice and discrimination. Even when we were in elementary school, we would always have fights. If somebody said, "Why you dirty Jap?" those were fighting words. He recalled that even the teachers were that way in the high school. "It's always been a prejudiced country," he concluded. School teacher Mary Tsukamoto came to the same conclusion. She grew up in Florin, California, where the large Japanese population appeared to pose a threat to white Americans. She remembered the Native Sons and Daughters and the American Legion and the California Federation of Labor and the Hearst Papers and the McClatchy Papers all claimed the Japanese were going to own all of California, that we were going to take over the land. So many people decided that they wanted to try to get us out. Publicity would periodically appear in the papers, and the campaign seemed to hit us every election year. We were innocent victims, but we have to understand the background if we are to understand what happened when the war broke out. Whether everyday acts of prejudice on the playground or election year xenophobia, the racism experienced by Japanese Americans had the backing of American cultural traditions and the legal system even prior to the outbreak of the Second World War. Issei may have been interviewed, investigated, and arrested right after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. They may have been singled out in the late winter and spring of 1942 as particularly dangerous because they were enemy aliens, non-citizens, and therefore supposedly more loyal to Japan than to the United States. But in fact, they were barred from becoming American citizens by law. The very first naturalization law for the United States, passed all the way back in 1790, had reserved naturalized citizenship only for free white persons. Now back then, 1790, it's safe to say that few of the original members of Congress imagined immigration from Asia would be an issue. And a number of them were slaveholders. So perhaps it isn't surprising that the law would read that way. But when it was revised some 80 years later, in 1870, after the end of slavery, and in the midst of a significant immigration from China, lawmakers only accounted for one of these populations, expanding the right of naturalization from free white persons, as it read in 1790, to include aliens of African nativity and persons of African descent. Non-whites from Asia were purposely excluded. Immigrants from Asia could not become naturalized American citizens. Indeed, they occupied an odd position. If African Americans were second-class citizens after the establishment of the Jim Crow segregation regimes in the South at the end of the 19th century, Asian immigrants were aliens ineligible for citizenship, right? This is a particular legal category that comes about in the late 19th and early 20th century. Right. So when the first large numbers of Japanese began to arrive on America's shores in the 1890s, and especially during the first decade of the 20th century, their ability to become American citizens appeared to be a foregone conclusion. This didn't stop them from coming. The Japanese population on the mainland of the US increased from around 2,000 in 1890 to more than 72,000 in 1910 to almost 140,000 in 1930. And while, like many labor migrations from other parts of the globe, a majority of those coming to the US were young men intending to return to Japan, a significant number of women also made the trip. So the number of immigrants by the 1920s was being supplemented by children born in the US, right? The Nisei. Japanese immigrants had established families, and they had established themselves in agriculture up and down the Pacific Coast states. And in cities in California and Oregon and Washington, they were starting businesses and creating ethnic economies and ethnic communities. Yet still, the Issei could not become citizens. Now, Nisei, of course, by virtue of their US births, were citizens, but those born in Japan, no matter how long they'd been in the US, no matter how Americanized, right, that's a term that was very popular at the time, no matter how Americanized they became, no matter how rooted to the land by virtue of their work on farms or their children's upbringing, were not considered capable of becoming proper Americans. In fact, in 1922, after Takao Ozawa challenged his status as an alien ineligible for citizenship, the US Supreme Court ruled that he was not entitled to naturalized citizenship because he was clearly not Caucasian, right? Those are the words of the court. Never mind that Ozawa had argued that he was an assimilated Japanese immigrant,
and therefore deserved the right to be naturalized. That though he had been born in Kanagawa, Japan, he moved to the U.S. as a teen in 1894, had worked his way through various schools, and had graduated from Berkeley High School. Forget that he had attended the University of California for 3 years, moved to Hawaii, worked for an American firm. Ignore that he had claimed to be a true American at heart, that he was Christian, that he spoke fluent English, and that his two children couldn't even speak Japanese and attended American schools. And disregard that a lower court had ruled that he was, quote, in every way eminently qualified under the statutes to become an American citizen, except in one way. He was not white. The U.S. Supreme Court decided that that one qualification, his race, was key. As a Japanese-American newspaper noted at the time, the decision shattered completely the slim hope we had entertained of becoming citizens. How ironic, then, that some 20 years later, the Issei would be the first folks targeted by the FBI, by the military, for their suspected lack of loyalty to the U.S., that the fact that they remained subjects of the Emperor of Japan was used as a rationale for their investigation, interrogation, and incarceration. But the cruel ironies don't stop there. The racial logic that concluded that non-white, non-African immigrants, namely the Issei, should be barred from becoming citizens because of their race, meant that even the Nisei, who, after all, were the same race as their parents, were also suspect. Though technically and legally American citizens by birth, Nisei were tarred by the same brush as the Issei. If alleged racial and biological characteristics made the Issei incapable of becoming true Americans, then given the racial science at the time, certainly the Nisei, despite their American nativity, would possess the same characteristics. In 1921, just before the Ozawa ruling, but more than 20 years before internment, the American Legion, a self-proclaimed patriotic veterans organization, in response to what it thought was the alarming increase of the Japanese population, called for the repeal of Section 1 of the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, right, the section which provides for birthright citizenship. Thomas W. McManus, chairman of the Legion's Committee on Oriental Immigration, testified, quote, "The right of citizenship we believe to be the most precious privilege given by our government. And if by race and instinct the parents cannot give wholehearted allegiance to our country, certainly the children of those parents will not give wholehearted loyalty to the nation." No wonder then, that when 20-year-old Seattle native Mio Sensaki was working in her family store in Alhambra, California on December 7th, 1941, the first question she was asked as she ventured out was, "Are you a Jap or are you an American?" There could be no middle ground. Legally and racially Japanese, Issei and Nisei, alien and citizen alike, could not be Americans. Attorney W.H. Anderson articulated this sentiment just 2 months after Pearl Harbor and more than 2 weeks before Executive Order 9066, when he advocated for the incarceration of all Japanese on the West Coast, arguing, quote, "A Japanese-American born of Japanese parents, notwithstanding his nominal brand of accidental citizenship, almost inevitably, and with the rarest of exceptions, grows up to be a Japanese, not an American." And indeed, it was the same logic issued by General John L. DeWitt, the primary architect of internment, when he succinctly and chillingly declared, "A Jap is a Jap." The arrest, detention, and incarceration of 120,000 men, women, and children of Japanese descent without due process of law, as folks like Mary Tsukamoto, Yamato Ichihashi, Jack Tano, and Fred Fujikawa knew, and as Julie Otsuka conveys in When the Emperor Was Divine, wasn't some fluke or exceptional moment. It was the logical conclusion of a political and legal system in which the distinction between those who could become American citizens and those who could not rested on race. Although perhaps exacerbated by war and extreme in its implementation, those policies that shaped the experiences of the woman, the girl, and the boy during the 1940s were rooted in a longer tradition of American nationalism and white supremacy. The forced confession with which Otsuka concludes her novel, the coerced admission that "I'm your nightmare," only served to confirm what military and political leaders believed they already knew, that real Americans were not Japanese. Thank you.
All right, so that was kind of a lot, but I'm happy to take questions. No questions? Questions? I answered all of your questions. You've got it completely. Yeah.
You ended with this whole discussion, which is really outstanding, about how Japanese weren't allowed to be citizens. What about the status of Chinese?
They weren't allowed to be citizens either until, I believe it's 1943. And that was a function, right, really of a kind of geopolitics, if we think about it, right? The Chinese were allies, right? So they repeal that portion of the law for Chinese. And they do it eventually for Filipinos and South Asians as well, folks from India. And it's not until the 1950s that Japanese immigrants could become citizens. Yes?
I was just wondering how you think the plight of the Japanese Americans kind of parallel with maybe other races, maybe, like even now in the isolated Northern American community.
Right. Right. No, I mean, I don't think it's any mistake that right after 9/11, right, the Japanese American Citizens League came out very quickly with a statement saying, look, we experienced this during the Second World War. This shouldn't happen, right? This shouldn't happen to Muslim Americans or Arab Americans. So there are all sorts of parallels, absolutely. Yeah. The title of my talk?
No.
Oh, the title of
the
book, When the Emperor Was Divine. Right, so part of how Japanese were perceived, right, by American academics and intellectuals, right, American politicians and policymakers, demagogues like a guy named V.S. McClatchy, who ran a bunch of newspapers, including the Sacramento Bee, William Randolph Hearst, those folks, right, the folks who published newspapers at the time. One of the ideas behind Japan and Japanese people in general, right, was that their religious and cultural, right, in the very fiber of their being, right, was this sort of belief in the divinity of the emperor, right, so that they would no matter what, right, be loyal to the emperor, right. So I think the title of the book seems to me, at least, right, to be kind of a nod to the notion or to be sort of opening the question of loyalty, right, which really is what, in the end, the sort of debates about internment pivoted on at the time, right? Could Japanese be loyal, right? So I think that's where it comes from, right? So there's a term from the time, Mikadoism, right, which is sort of the kind of notion that this religious belief in the divinity of the emperor. Yeah. So there was another hand. Yeah, there you go. So yeah, I mean, there's discrimination, and there are folks who are investigated and arrested and interrogated, right, by the FBI.
So the
question was the U.S. wasn't only at war with Japan, right? So there were other nations with whom the U.S. was at war, right, including, most obviously Germany and Italy, right? What happened to folks? Were there other sort of acts? And certainly there were everyday acts of discrimination and prejudice, but the state, right? The state's response to Italian and German immigrants, right? Those enemy aliens was much more circumscribed, much more narrow, right? So there were investigations of possible folks who may or may not have been working as spies, right? But there's not the large scale roundup of German immigrants and Italian immigrants. Nothing that looks like, I mean, every single person of Japanese ancestry who lived in on the west coast of the U.S., right, was incarcerated, right, which is sort of a logistical feat in and of itself if you think about it. But, um, but nothing on that scale was attempted for German or Italian immigrants. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah. So concentration camp, right? So I was just talking about this before the lecture, right? I mean, concentration camp, in our sort of popular historical memory, right? I mean, it conjures images of Auschwitz and Dachau and those awful scenes, right, from Europe. And my sense is that even though the term concentration camp was being used to refer to, right, what we now call internment camps, and concentration camp is actually rooted, there were concentration camps, say, in the Philippines, right, in the U.S. war in the Philippines, the first part of the 20th century, right? Now it seems to take on a particular image, right, of Europe, the Nazi treatment extermination of Jews during the Second World War. And it seems to me as though there was a decision made sort of over time that this doesn't necessarily, those two things are not necessarily comparable. Maybe, or at least that if that's what a concentration camp is, this is something else, right? Japanese Americans weren't going to be exterminated, right? Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, I don't know. part of it is there's a kind of historical phenomenon, right? Where often there's a kind of that's those people over there dealing with that. That's their problem, not our problem. But, you know, Roosevelt is sitting in Washington, D.C. on the West Coast. He's signing Executive Order 9066, right? I mean, there is the idea, right, that this is a necessary and a good step, right, to take. I don't know if that answers your question. There's no authority. I mean, I guess even before the military zones were created, right, they were arresting them, right, the FBI arrested, right? So on December 7th and December 8th, right, before public proclamation number one, right, creates those military zones, right, months before those are created, folks are being arrested. I think the FBI was very engaged in this. Questions here. Yeah.
Oh. Okay, so the question about when the Chinese were allowed to have their citizenship brought this to mind. I'm from New York City, and over there a lot, I'm guessing many places, not necessarily form based reasons, but to generalize a lot, because people from similar countries already had it. I'm Hispanic, so it doesn't matter whether you're from Colombia or from Venezuela, you're all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. I mean, so the question is about the ways how it worked with Japanese and Chinese, right? During the Second World War, in particular, right? Whether there's a sort of a conflation of the two, right? And whereas the Chinese were granted the right of and only 100 a year could become American citizens, right? So it's not sort of a token move in 1943, right? The differentiation between Chinese and Japanese occurred, and how that happened. So I mean, race functions in funny ways, right? So part of it is that kind of conflation, right? And we see it time and time again historically. So whether it's there's an infamous, right, murder of a Chinese American in Detroit in 1982. Right, and his assailants beat him to death, thinking he's Japanese, or not even caring whether or not he's Japanese, but calling him Japanese while they beat him to death. Right, it's a racially motivated murder, but there's that kind of conflation between they don't care. Right, so there's that dynamic. So one of the things that we see during the Second World War in places like LA or San Francisco for Chinese Americans, right, is this sort of distancing, right? This dynamic of saying, I'm not Japanese. And in fact, I don't have the slide here, but there are these very sort of troubling pictures, right? And they're moving, but they're also troubling pictures of signs in front of Chinese businesses, right, saying not Japanese. Right? Don't mistake me for one of those guys. Right? Because the consequences for that kind of conflation are pretty dire. Yeah. What there's a I'm sorry? Yeah, there's a small Japanese population in New York City or Chicago, right? Those folks aren't subject to internment. Folks in Hawaii, right, weren't subject to internment. Even though the proportion of the population of Hawaii was Japanese was much greater than the proportion of the population, right? So why only the West Coast and why not the East Coast? So a lot of it is that right, if we think about the geography, right, that seems to be the most immediate area perhaps under threat, right? So if we're thinking of military reasons, that would be, right, the West Coast would seem to be more vulnerable than, right, this is the era before jet airplanes, right? So the range of it's also where the largest concentration of Japanese in the U.S. are, in the mainland U.S. are, right? So something like, I want to say something like 70% of the Japanese and Japanese American population, right, resided in California, resided in California alone, right. So and when you add Oregon and Washington State to the mix, that's most of the vast majority of Japanese and Japanese Americans were on the West Coast. Yeah, so one of these guys, I'm trying to remember for the life of me, one of the three gentlemen who brought lawsuits, right, against the U.S. government. I know it's not Gordon Hirabayashi. I don't remember whether it's Korematsu or Yasui. Actually, like, evaded the curfew. And what his suit was about the constitutionality of the curfew, right? I forget which proclamation order it was, but he evaded the curfew. And apparently he wanted to hang out with his girlfriend, who was white, and she wasn't being interned. So there were sort of other reasons for it. But part of it was, this is wrong. I don't want to participate in this. He goes so far as to have plastic surgery, right, to have his appearance altered, right, to try to escape internment, right. And yet they still find him, right. So when you think, quite apart from the justice or injustice of it all, when we think about the logistical, right, undertaking. It's a pretty stunning, achievement may be the wrong word, but it's a pretty stunning sort of accomplishment. It's definitely the wrong word, but you know what I mean. Yeah, lots of questions. I'll take that one and we'll go back here. Yeah.
The last chapter of the book, I'm just wondering if you have any opinion
why you get a perspective. Yeah, it's a good question. So not the sort of final.
Repeat the question.
So the question is why was there only one chapter from the perspective of the father? So I'm going to do the professorial thing and evade the question, and really sort of say, actually, it's a great question for your seminars, right? So is it tomorrow or is it Tuesday or maybe both days? Tomorrow, right? You all are going to. I think it's a wonderful, and I think actually it's not readily. I mean, the answer is not there in the text, right? It's a matter of interpretation, so it's worth thinking about. I mean, the other professorial thing to do would be for me to say, well, what do you think? So just be ready for that in the next few years, right? Hand there. I'll get to you over here. Right. So my sense is that he was a little like So there were some folks who were deemed particular threats, right? Who were taken away to different detention centers, right? So that was part of that. That's part of my sense is that's what he was about, right? And in part because right, he has some. He's in some business that goes away, right? That's what we're told by Otsuka, right? In my sense, it's a Japanese business, right? And often, right, just like the guy who was who worked for the Japanese, the import export business, right? There are certain jobs that were deemed particularly suspect, all right? Other than that, right, there were folks who were sent, mostly people were sent as part of their, communities or neighborhoods were sort of put in camps together, right? So you weren't there necessarily with everybody who was a stranger, that there was some sort of order to it. There were a couple of camps, in particular Tule Lake in Northern California, which was sort of the where all the sort of troublesome prisoners were sent. So if you caused a ruckus in Topaz, Arizona, you were sent to Tule Lake. You would be sent to Tule Lake, and then there's a whole group of folks who end up in the federal penitentiary as well. So not just in a detention center, but in prison itself. Yeah. So there was the green shirt. Yeah. Yes. So the question is, was this happening in other countries? Canada. absolutely. And in fact, in certain ways, right, there's a relatively new book out that makes the argument that in certain ways Canada was much harsher about this, right? That the internment sort of came swifter and So yeah, it was happening in other places. I mean, there's also a group of folks, right? So Japanese immigrants aren't just coming to Canada and the U.S., right? They're all over the place, and in part, they're other parts of the Western Hemisphere, right? In Latin America and places like that, and the U.S. is encouraging, right, folks to arrest Japanese nationals in places like Peru, and then ship them to the U.S. to be imprisoned in the U.S., right? So it's sort of a hemispheric phenomenon in certain ways. Other question? Yeah.
So you were saying how if you were a Japanese American at this time, you knew kind of what was coming.
Yeah.
Were there any sort of communities that tried to escape the Western Hemisphere?
Yeah, to try to get out. Yeah, I don't know. That's actually a good question, right? So if you can sort of see the writing on the wall, what do you do, right? And it's actually a question perhaps on a, right? Is this professorial? Is this a cop-out? Maybe it's a cop-out. What the heck? But it may be worth trying to exercise your historical imagination, right? So in the absence of evidence of this, right, we don't know, I don't know, and I'm sure other people might know, whether large groups of people tried to evade, right, internment. My sense is that it didn't happen. But to try to put yourself in the place, right, of someone facing this circumstance, right, and think about what choices you've got. Right. I teach internment every year. Right. As part of either part of the U.S. history survey course here at Cornell, or as part of a course called Introduction to Asian American History that I teach every fall. And every year, at least someone in the class sort of asks the question. Well, or makes the statement. Doesn't ask the question. Right. Makes the statement. Well, I wouldn't put up with that. Right? How could you just go along with that? Right. And so part of the exercise in that class is to sort of try to imagine what it's like, right, to face the power of the American state, right, the American military. I don't have pictures of it here, but some of the iconic photos, right, of internment, of the transportation of internees, right, they're being guarded by soldiers, right. The oral histories that I excerpted quotes from. There's one oral history that talks about. Oh no, I'm thinking of Yamato Ichihashi, the Stanford professor, right? He writes this great letter to the president of Stanford about the conditions in the camp, right? And their food is awful, and he's got an upset stomach. I mean, he's in his 60s at the time. It's a rough go. He's having a rough go of things, and he's saying, things got better last week because there were film crews around, right? And they wanted to show that things were getting. We're getting better, and in fact, the soldiers who were guarding us seemed to respond to us. But this is to say that they were all being guarded by armed soldiers, right? They were behind barbed wire, right? So what choices do you have? And I think it's an interesting question. Sure.
Well, guarded by armed soldiers and American public that supported the action.
Right.
So like you could go underground and have a lot of support.
Right. So the question is exactly where would you go, right? What sort of support would you get? And even the NAACP at the time, right, wasn't terribly supportive of Japanese Americans. Yeah.
How many soldiers were involved in the Japanese?
It's a great question. I really don't know the answer to it. Right. And I mean, it's a great question because I mean, when you think about it, we're engaged in war. Right. As a use of wartime resources, it may seem a little nutty, right? But when you think about, you know, if you're going to go to these lengths, right, to do something like this, right, there, you know, and there's a report that sort of claims that there's an actual threat, you're going to want to make sure that that's resourced in a particular kind of way. There's a wonderful article that talks, this is sort of history geek, whatever, technical stuff, but that the New Deal, right, that the sort of expansion of the federal government in the 1930s under Roosevelt, right, the creation of particular kinds of federal programs, right, sets the stage, right, for the WRA and for internment, enables internment, right. So the article I think is called "Public Works at War" or something like this, and how much like the WPA or the CCC, right, these sort of programs created by the Roosevelt government during the New Deal, the WRA was one of these public works administration entities. The logistics of it all are pretty interesting. I'm going to sort of see if there are other questions. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Why did they choose to intern in the Roosevelt before?
Yeah, so you got to wonder whether Japan would want them, right? And the logistics of international relations, you've got to actually negotiate that with a country with whom you're at war. Right. There are a small group of folks, and I don't remember the numbers before someone asks. Right. There's a small group of people who renounce their American citizenship, Nisei, right, who haven't spent much time in Japan at all, and are sent back to Japan or sent to Japan. Right. But when you think about the logistics of negotiating during wartime with an enemy state and whether those folks that nation would be willing to receive these folks, that's the reason, right? And it's not like traveling the Pacific is safe during this period either, right? It's war. No. Other questions, yeah?
Do you know where this particular book was chosen?
yeah, you know what? I don't. Should I get myself into trouble here and say that the choice of the first year reading project book or the new student reading project book, it's run by the associate vice provost for undergraduate education, I think Laura Brown, and her office. I believe she has a committee that she works with, but I wasn't privy to any of those conversations. I was actually because I'm an Asian American historian, right? This is some of the stuff that I study, and I'm actually, my current research is on the period that precedes internment, so the 19-teens and 1920s. I was totally delighted to see this as the choice because it's sort of right up my alley in all sorts of ways. And I actually have a personal connection to the book, which I wasn't going to reveal, but what the heck, right? So Julia Tsuka, her family's from Northern California originally, or at least her mom's family is from Mountain View, California. But they moved subsequently to Southern California, which is where I grew up. And Julie's youngest, well, is she the eldest? Anyway, Julie's younger brother and I were really good friends in middle school and high school. We were the two geeky Asian boys who played oboe in the orchestra and had every single class together, right? So it was sort of neat to sort of see this as the choice. Yeah.
Well, I mentioned you revealed that two children have the same identification number.
Right.
So that would, like, obviously children in the same family would have together. But was there anything in place if
children were to become separated from both their parents, or if they were to become orphans while they were in the camp?
That's a great question. And in fact, we know a lot about the experience of children in the camps, right? There's been more research on there. A couple of great PBS documentaries. There's a documentary called Rabbit in the Moon about sort of generational tensions. How that worked precisely, I actually don't know. I mean, so those are two different things. One is being separated from your parents.
Right, or one would be.
And the other would be being orphaned.
Like if their mother had actually died and their father was in the camp.
I would venture to guess that there would be mechanisms involved for that. The separation thing, which, you know, those of us who have gotten lost as little kids, right, the anxiety of getting on a train and not knowing where your parents are, right, that occurs to me now as you ask the question, and I'm not sure what happened in that instance. So, yeah. Other questions or comments? Yeah.
I think you mentioned this a little earlier, but was there any significant protest from non-Japanese groups? You said that the NAACP didn't have like a whole ton of protest, and the general American public kind of accepted it. But besides those three Japanese guys, and then the lawsuits, and then
the ACLU was incredibly engaged. And in fact, the lawyers for the attorneys, or the attorneys for the lawsuits, began through the ACLU. Right, they were incredibly active. The Quakers, right, the American Friends, were pretty supportive, right? So there were other folks, but not a whole lot of allies, right? Which begs a set of questions, right? And it's interesting to note, right, there aren't a lot of allies, right? In the Chinese, during the Second World War, right, you see the signs, not Chinese, or not Japanese, right? I'm not one of those guys, right? So after the Second World War ends, right, America in a few years enters into the Cold War, right? And by 1949, right, the nationalists in China, with whom the U.S. is allied, lose the civil war in China to the communists, right? And the communists rule all of China by 1950. In the early 1950s, President Truman, right, actually writes, I believe he writes a memo. And he basically says, look, we have to keep the capacity for these sorts of camps, right? Because the Chinese may be next, right? The Chinese in America, who may be sympathizers with the communists, right, in Mao's China, right, might be the next suspected enemy alien, right? So it's interesting, right, this question of allies and you know, what we passively sort of let happen. Right, because it's not us, right? It could be that next group, right? And the Chinese in the 1950s were potentially that next group. Right? So that question of allies is really an interesting one. Other questions? I know there are people over here saying, please don't raise your hand. Please don't raise your hand. All right. Is there one over here? Oh, there you go. All right. That's what I like to see. Totally unafraid. Yeah.
Would the government have been concerned if non-Japanese people spoke out publicly against the internment?
Would they have been concerned?
Would they pursue, interviewing them and making sure they were...
That's a... Huh.
And that's kind of goes along with the Red Scare.
Yeah. So, I mean, and again, I know more about... the 19-teens and 1920s, right? During this, what we call the, right, historians, because we like names for everything, the first Red Scare, right, in the 19-teens, right, the anti-radicalism. That model is in place from the 19-teens. Whether it would have been followed in the Second World War, I don't know whether it was or not, but certainly, right, the investigation of radicals, right, there was precedent for it. Right, so it's not something that just comes about in the 1950s under McCarthy, right? Under the McCarthy era, right? It's something that is rooted in earlier sort of anti-radical movements. Yeah. There was another hand over here. Yeah.
Was there ever an idea that perhaps the camps were based on
reservations that Native Americans were put on.
So the question is about the relationship between internment camps and Indian reservations, right? There's a fascinating book. I'll call it a fascinating book that actually looks at Indian reservations, internment camps, and public housing projects, right? As sort of these attempts by the government, right, to control, right, social control, right? They're all there. So whether there's an actual link in the architects, right, of these things, I don't think so, although I don't know for sure. But there's certainly, right, a kind of philosophical and ideological connection among those things, right? So how do we get folks to do what we want them to do through housing, right? And through the removal and, right, I mean, all of the sort of boxes are ticked, right? That make those things kind of comparable in certain ways. The place that actually, and I didn't talk about this, but where they're similar, right, in particular, right? So a lot of Native Americans, right, the Indian reservations, right? Some of that is because other folks want that land that they're sitting on, right? So over the course of the 19-teens and 1920s, Japanese immigrant farmers and Japanese American farmers are becoming a dominant force in California agriculture, right? And I don't remember precisely what the percentages are, but they control a good deal of the California flour, right? So cut flowers and things like that of fruits and vegetables, right? Production in California, and in fact, prior to Executive Order 9066, the sort of industry organization, right, for flower growers on one hand and vegetable and fruit growers on the other, right, actually come out in support of internment, right? They want to see Japanese farmers taken off the land too, right? And that's something we don't talk about much. And certainly when I learned about Japanese internment in high school, that wasn't part of the equation, right? That there's an actual economic motive, right, for Japanese internment. Get them off the land so we can take it over. Yeah. There's a, yes, you've been very patient. Do I know? No. that's a simple short answer. Why is there a paper crane on the cover of the book? Actually, my edition of the book doesn't have a paper crane on it. Can I ask you why you ask? Huh.
Like, you know how when you fold a thousand grains, it was supposed to be like carrier cancer or something from the radiation?
Okay.
You know, like, we had a presentation.
All right. No, I have no idea why there's a paper crane on the cover of the book. I'm going to venture a guess and say that I'm not sure Julia Tsuka knows why there's a paper crane on the cover of her book. Often these decisions aren't made by the authors themselves. They're made by other people, right? All right. So other questions. I hear restlessness. I think that's an okay thing. It's a beautiful afternoon. It's been a long afternoon. So let me just say once again, thank you for your attention this afternoon, and good luck with the rest of your Cornell career.